Text number 13. Pura pita no bhagavan. Daksho duhitri vatsalaha. We're having class. Ari Bol, we're having class over here. Pura pita no bhagavan. Tapsho duhitra vatsalaha.
Tapsho duhitra vatsalaha.
Pam vinita varam vatsa.
Pam vinita varam vatsa.
Itya prichata nat prita.
Itya prichata nat prita.
Pura pita no bhagavan.
Pura pita no bhagavan.
Tapsho duhitri vatsalaha.
Tapsho duhitri vatsalaha.
Kam vinita varam vatsa.
Kam vinita varam vatsa.
Itya prichata nat prita.
Itya prichata nat prita.
Pura.
Pura.
In days long ago.
In days long ago.
Pita,
Pita.
Father.
Father.
Naha.
Naha.
Our.
Bhagavan.
The most opulent.
The most opulent.
Dakshaha.
Dakshaha.
Daksha.
Daksha.
Duhitri vatsalaha.
Duhitri vatsalaha.
Affectionate to his daughters.
Affectionate to his daughters.
Come.
Unto whom?
Vinita.
Vinita.
You want to accept.
You want to accept.
Varam.
Varam.
Your husband.
Your husband.
Vatsaha.
Vatsaha.
Oh, my children.
Oh, my children.
Iti.
Thus.
Aprichata.
Aprichata.
Inquired.
Inquired.
Naha.
Naha.
Us.
Us.
Pritak.
Pritak.
Separately.
Separately.
Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. In days long ago, our father, the most opulent Daksha, who was affectionate to his daughters, asked each of us separately whom we would prefer to select as our husband. Purport. It appears from this verse that free selection of a husband was allowed by the father, but not by free association. The daughters were asked separately to submit their selection of a husband, who was famous for his acts and personality. The ultimate selection depended on the choice of the father. This is all relative. Daksha is being called Bhagavan. Of course, he's Bhagavan in a very relative sense. Bhagavan is properly the title of the Supreme Lord. Sometimes great sages and devotees like Narada and some are called Bhagavan. Lord Shiva can be called Bhagavan. And then Prajapatis are also very exalted beings, very powerful. And relatively to us, they're Bhagavan. But it's all relative. And the importance of all this, these dharmas that Prabhupada is discussing here, like the dharma of Sri Dharma, the dharma of how to take care of your daughter, how to get her married. These are relative considerations. We could neglect them or ridicule them, but actually this is all required for life in the material world. We have relative considerations. Only someone who is a perfect Paramahamsa can think that he doesn't have to worry about these things. Everyone else has some regulative principles that he has to follow that are relative. Even being a brahmana is a relative position. Even being a sannyasi is a material designation. And the dharma of a sannyasi is actually an external thing. It's relative. I'm sorry. So, but for life to go on, even for spiritual life to go on in the material world, for conditioned souls to have an opportunity, not just for material success, but even for spiritual success, they need these to pay attention to these relative concerns. Just like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took sannyas. What does Lord Chaitanya need to take sannyas for? Of course, it's his pleasure, it's his pastime, but what's the necessity for it? He's the Supreme Lord. He doesn't have to make a show of anything, of renunciation. But he did it because conditioned souls could not recognize that he was God. Many were offensive to him. You know, there's a saying that no one's a saint in his hometown. So in Navadvip, everyone thought that he's just, you know, Nimai Pandit, and they very often disrespected him because of that. But by taking sannyas, that changed the whole story. Same boy, but when he puts on the saffron and takes the danda, then everyone, sannyasi. Yeah. And just the Indian mentality is to treat a sannyasi as something spiritual. You know, just to have respect for the symbol. Sometimes it gets you know, a little absurd sometimes, no matter what bad character that person has, because he's wearing saffron, he's honored, and people throw all their money at him. And he can get away with all sorts of abominable things. But just because the principle is abused doesn't mean it's not appropriate and useful. It's a material thing that people pay respect to the symbol. But it accomplishes something necessary. Conditioned souls need to learn respect for spiritual authority. Better to go too far and to become fanatical than to have no respect. So the material principle, although it's only relative, does serve a transcendental purpose. Therefore, in our Gaudiya Vaishnava culture, we have this all these trappings of sannyas and so on. Because that's what the conditioned souls need. Prabhupada engaged his disciples in selling books. How is this the business of Vaishnavas? This is business. So why are the, especially the brahmacharis, why was Prabhupada pushing them to engage in this business of selling books? And those who don't understand could even criticize Prabhupada for that. That he was just a businessman. I hear it even from former disciples of Prabhupada. You know, they really lose their faith and their understanding completely. They think that Prabhupada was just a businessman out to make money. Or that's all he knew how to do. Not understanding that this material relative program of selling something, selling a commodity, is serving a transcendental purpose. Prabhupada was so brilliant to dovetail the energies and the propensities of the people in our modern culture. What do we do? What is our culture? Our culture is just go shopping, buy things. That's all the culture we have. Get money and spend it. We don't know anything else. We don't know any other, we have no other culture, no other values. Nothing else in the world is important but money and the commodities it can buy. Even our education, we purchase with our money. So Prabhupada looked at that situation and said, okay, that's the situation, we can use that for Krishna. And he engaged his disciples in doing what they knew how to do. Sell. That's their propensity, use it. For the transcendental purpose of spreading the glories of Srimad Bhagavatam. And not only did it dovetail their propensities, but it accomplished exactly what needed to be done for the purpose of Lord Chaitanya's perfectly pure intentions. So in the hands of pure devotees, all these material things even getting daughters married and selling various things, can be used for the highest purposes. The important thing is to somebody to have that transcendental consciousness. Then the human society can be very nicely organized for progressive purposes. This is ditti. You can, you know, get confused. Over next door, we're doing Kardama and Devahut. You hear this is Kashyapa and ditti. Anyway, Swayambhuvamana was Devahuti's father, and he helped organize human society. Of course, he was the first organizer of human society. He founded the company, Human Corporation. So he was the first organizer of it. Other manus took over later, and kings had been deputized on the earth. So many kings in various dynasties. And then the world became split up into many countries. So many governments of these countries are, and the legislative bodies of these governments are, have the responsibility of organizing human society. But it began with Swayambhuva Manu. He's the first ruler, the first legislator. He made the law book. There are many Dharma Shastras, and Manusmriti is one of them. But it's very prominent. Even today, it's appealed to even before the other Dharma Shastras. There are about 57, I think, Dharma Shastras that are known, that are available. But Manusmriti is the most prominent. And there it's not a book of laws in the modern sense, although it sort of is. It does describe crimes and particular punishments for particular crimes, but it's not only that. It's describing more in a much has a much broader scope. It describes how conditioned souls should behave, how inhuman society, living together with other people. People with other interests and of other characters, how to live together and stay each within their own limits. It's not just a question of protecting property rights. Now, in a mercantile society, that's the main concern, is how to protect the property from the poor people who want to take it from you. How can the rich stay rich and not have to suffer the revenge of the oppressed poor. But Manu's interest was much more liberal, much more broad than that, not just protecting property rights, so that is also there. If a person steals, he has to be punished. If he steals more than the equivalent of 1 kilo of gold, or one certain amount of gold, then that's grand larceny, a major theft, and the punishment is very severe. If he steals less than that, the punishment is not so severe. So these things are prescribed. But there are many more things. Basically, first of all, he defines the duties of the varnas and the ashramas. He focuses especially on the duties of the Brahmins and Kshatriyas, and of the Brahmacharis and Grihasthas. The Vaishyas and Shudras don't need such thorough training in what their duty is. It's relatively simple. They can just be directed by the educated classes, the Brahmins and Kshatriyas. And the less educated, the less cultured, the Vaishyas and the Shudras, don't need much education. Vaishyas need some practical education. Enough mathematics so they can keep accounts and calculate the change, calculate bills. The Shudras practically just need, you know, if they're going to become artisans, they need training in their own skill, in the particular skill, and that they can learn as apprentices. They don't have to go to the university to learn a practical skill. Nowadays, we have established universal liberal education. Everyone has to stay in high school until he's, I don't know, 16, 18 years old, locked up in a prison, getting a so-called education, so-called general education. When actually, it would be much more practical if at least half of these young people were serving as apprentices and learning a practical skill, and not locked up in a prison where they're subjected to torture of various kinds. And it used to be like that. until the middle of the 19th century, in the United States at least, that it was common that young people were working. Children even were working. But that became a scandal. Oh, child labor. You know, horrible. But actually, for a young person to get trained up in a skill, if he's a shudra, then that's appropriate. That he's being prepared for his life, rather than wasting time, you know, in a classroom where he's not learning anything. Just learning to rebel. So that system is there. Organized by the higher classes to let everybody know what he needs to know to carry on his life in his own position. That was all explained by Manu, how to do that. He focused especially on what the Brahmins should do, what they should do and not do. Important principle for Brahmins is cleanliness. So what's clean and what's not clean? And when something becomes unclean, how to clean it? He gives great detail in how to cleanse, how to purify things that have become contaminated. How a Brahmin who has committed intentionally or accidentally some transgression of his dharma, who has done a sinful thing, how he has to rectify himself. These things are prescribed. And the duties of a Brahmin. A Brahmachari Brahmin, a Grahastha Brahmin, are explained in brief by Manu. He doesn't have to explain all the ritual duties of the Brahmins and how they have to study the Vedas. These are explained in other books. How to perform sacrifice, how to study the Vedas. There are the many texts, Griha Sutras, Shrauta Sutras, explain these things. So the Dharma Shastras don't dwell too much on that. And then even more than explanation of the duties of the Brahmanas, there's even longer. The Brahmanas get 2 chapters, I think. Kshatriyas get 7 chapters. The duties of a king. This he gives very much elaborate attention to. Brahmanas, they study the Shastras. That's their main business. But the Kshatriyas' duties are much more complicated. They have to manage and organize human society. They have to see that everyone's engaged in their proper duty, and that those who transgress are dealt with properly, including criminals in your own state and enemies from without. A Kshatriya has to deal with them very strongly. If a Kshatriya does not use violence, then he's remiss in his duty. A Kshatriya is allowed to take 1/6 of the income of his citizens as tax. He has a right to claim 1/6 of everybody's gross income. And he will get 1/6 of their pious reactions. Whatever good they've accomplished, whatever good karma they've acquired, he will also get that. Not just 1/6 of their wealth, but 1/6 of their pious karma. But he's responsible to do the duties of a king. If he does not use the danda, the rod of punishment, against criminals and against foreign enemies, then he's failed to carry out his responsibility. And instead of getting 1/6 of everybody's pious credits, he'll get 1/6 of everybody's sinful reactions and go to hell. If you take any country, no matter how good a country it is, and total up 1/6 of everybody's sinful reactions in the whole country, that's enough to send, no matter who you are, to send you to hell. So Manu says that Kshatriya will go to hell who fails to use violence in carrying out his duties. If he doesn't want to use violence, then he should have been a Brahmin and not a Kshatriya. All these things are discussed very clearly by Manu in his Manu Smriti, and thus he's done the service of helping the conditioned souls find out how to live properly in a progressive human civilization, which gives the support for spiritual life. It's required. Therefore, Prabhupada wanted us also to reorganize this Varnashram system on a transcendental basis for the modern world. Without it, without the social infrastructure, without the support it's very hard for most people to practice Krishna consciousness. They have to be engaged properly. They have to understand what their position in life is and what they're supposed to do, even their material duties. If they're not put in the proper position, if they're not clear about what their identity is, then it's hard for them to make progress in Krishna consciousness, most people. Prabhupada has reclaimed a few thousand who can take the initiative of just dropping out of society and becoming Hare Krishnas. But most people can't do that. They have to be able to stay, to hold on to a material position, and also practice Krishna consciousness. That's the way to expand the Krishna consciousness movement beyond a few tens of thousands to millions and hundreds of millions. By reorganizing the Varnashram, Adivi Varnashram, to bring everybody in, to engage everybody also in Krishna's service and in Nam Sankirtana. Okay, so therefore the discussion in the Bhavatam of what seems to be material principles of how a daughter is to be properly married, it's not completely irrelevant to us. Somebody has to understand these things and implement them. If daughters are not properly married, if some civilized principles are not followed, then everything, society is ruined. Strishtu dushtasu varshneya jayate varna sankara. When the ladies become corrupt, when the women in the community are corrupt, then the first bad effect is the birth of unwanted population. What's unwanted population? Look around, go to any place in the world, including India, and look on the streets. The streets are full of unwanted population. Who's performing Garbhadhan Samskara? Who's going about properly having children? It's all Varna Sankara. Even among the Brahmanas in India, they perform Garbhadhan Samskara once in marriage, that's it, if at all. That's just the beginning. When there are when there's Varna Sankara, then society becomes chaotic. Then people become like animals. The Varna Sankara are generally not very trainable spiritually. A great soul like Srila Prabhupada can do it anyway. He can engage even low-class people in the highest quality of transcendental work. But not everybody can be picked up like that. Really, society has to be purified. Instead of all this sankara. Sankara means mixture. Everything mixed up. The shudras and the Vaishyas and the Sudras are ruling the countries. Some places it's the businessmen who are in control. In some places the businessmen have been kicked out and the proletariat have taken over. But it's the two lowest classes that are ruling. And nobody even bothers to become a Brahmin or a Kshatriya. Who needs it? If you have money, you're in control. So who needs spiritual education? Who needs to become noble? If you have a gun, an army with guns, then you can rule. You don't need to have any nobility, any good qualities. You don't have to know how to fight. Let someone else fight. You just control it with money and buy an army and take over. This is the fallen state of human society. But what needs to be done is to rectify it, to straighten out all this mixture. Everything is mixed up. Nobody understands their proper position. Intellectuals are doing business, or worse, the intellectuals, the so-called Brahmins, are engaged in all sorts of sinful activities, living like dogs, and they're calling themselves intellectuals, scholars, professors. But these professors are worse than dogs in their personal behavior. Well, they're not Brahmanas. The intellectuals are not Brahmanas. There are no Kshatriyas. There are no real rulers. The rulers are just, at best, successful businessmen. At worst, they're just hoodlums or criminals or animals, the rulers. This is a different gamut from the you know, the respectable businessman at the top of the scale down to the, you know, cannibal. This is the scope of our governments, our rulers in the modern world. So it's all mixed up. People unqualified are taking the wrong positions, or people are taking, you know, trying to do everything at once, to be everything, to be a Brahmin and a Kshatriya and a Vaishya all at once. It just leads to chaos and confusion. So this society does need to be reorganized. People should be trained up properly. Someone who's going to be an actual intellectual, a spiritual leader, should not just go to a seminary, you know, but he should go to a proper seminary, a place where there's even discussion now in the GBC about this, that there should be schools for training up gurus. Seminary, like where you train up priests. There must be proper training how to be a spiritual leader. How not to be an intellectual who's still living like a cat or a dog. So that's part of the mission of ISKCON. It's part of the business Prabhupada wanted. He wanted to lay the foundation, to plant the seeds by vast distribution of books. But his next program was to organize human society so that more than a few thousand can actually become devotees. So these topics are discussed in Srimad Bhagavatam. Prabhupada didn't just insert these things on his own. They're there in the original text. And Prabhupada elaborates them in his purports, discusses so many topics of how human society should be organized. It's important to understand. Those who are going to be doing this organizing, they should understand that the women have to be taken care of properly. The daughter, the father's responsibility is to see that the daughter is married to a proper husband. The daughter should not have the final choice, and certainly she should not be obliged to become a prostitute in order to find a husband, to sell her body, which is what young women in the world nowadays have to do. They have to dress provocatively and behave provocatively and associate freely with men, flirting around and doing everything they do to get it, just to get a husband. It's the urge for security. The woman needs a husband to give her security, financial security and emotional security and children and a home and the things she needs. She needs a husband. But why, to get a husband, she has to behave like a prostitute? You know, that's what's demanded of them. That's what they're forced into. Because the fathers don't take the responsibility to get them married properly. So these things are important. It's not that the brahmacharis and sannyasis don't have to worry about that. Things are difficult. It's hard for a sannyasi to preach because of this chaos. Nobody wants to hear. Nobody can hear. Because they're living like cats and dogs. So these things do have to be straightened out for Krishna consciousness to flourish. Therefore, the discussion in this verse and other verses like it is not irrelevant. Very much what we need to understand. Hare Krishna. Okay, so I'll stop. Are there any questions or comments?
You say in Pada Sankara means mixing up?
Yeah, Sankara is mixture, but it's especially inappropriate mixture. You know, wrong kind of mixture. You know, any actually mixing of classes is generally not so good. There's allowable mixture, you know, when the man is higher than the woman, and the woman's lower class. That's allowable. So it's not considered varnasankara. Varnasankara is when it's against the rules. It's, you know, the man is higher class than the woman, and you know, the proper samskaras are not performed, and so on. Then the result is Varna Sankara, mixing up. Inappropriate mixing. Mixing is not necessarily bad. You know, the Ayurvedic doctor gets various herbs and he makes mixtures of them. And when he does it appropriately, the medicine becomes very potent. But an inappropriate mixture can cause damage and disease and death. So it's not just that mixture is bad, but it's the mixture, if it's going to be a mixture, it has to be appropriately done. Sometimes you do want to mix things.
What about Sudha Goswami? Was he? What was his mix?
His mix, Sutta, means that the father is a Kshatriya and the mother is a Brahmin. Mm. or at least, you know, the founder of your Sutta family was a Kshatriya who married a Brahmin, and then the generations after are all Sutas.
Right.
At least for seven generations. And he considered that a fault. Daushkulyam adim vidunoti shigram mahatman man anabhidana yoga. By associating with and even just repeating the names of such great souls as you who are present is purifying me of the contamination of my low birth, is what Sutta Goswami said about himself more than once. You know, because it's just, you know, from the material point of view, to be a Sutta is not a good thing. You know, it's an unfortunate birth. Although a Sutta, because his father's a Kshatriya and his mother's a Brahmin, he's got good qualities, but they're mixed up. They're mixed up in the wrong way. Mm-hmm. So he can't function as a proper Brahmin. He can't study the Vedas. He can't fight. He's not allowed to carry weapons and fight as a Kshatriya. So what can he do? He's smart, and he's strong and able, but he can't serve either as a Brahmin or a Kshatriya. So two things are picked out for him. He can drive a chariot. He can be in the war, but he can't carry the weapons. So chariot driver is an important job. You know, the life of the warrior depends on his chariot driver. This is, you know, this, the intelligence and ability, agility of the chariot driver are important. So he has to be competent. And the other job is he can recite Puranas, which is also a very important job, but not exactly the job of a Brahmin. Yeah. So, you know, he's got some respectable work to do, but still he's in a degraded position. Materially. Sutta Goswami Ugrashrava, he was special. Therefore the sages are glorifying him. You know, and are sitting at his feet. Not because of his material disqualification, they're ignoring that and looking at his spiritual qualification instead. But materially he's fallen.
Right. What about Sanjay? He must have been in like a similar situation.
He was also a Sutta. But he was being engaged as a secretary.
Right.
By Dhritarashtra.
Right. But he was fighting on the battlefield, right?
Sanjaya.
Well, there's that story that he was on the battlefield in some capacity, and he went to leave, and then...
It might have been as a chariot driver.
Yeah.
Might have been. Vidura also, who was the son of a Shudra, so he was considered, you know, a Dasiputra. Even worse, you know, lower class.
Right.
Father was a sage, but the mother was a Shudra. So that's even more degraded. He had a bow and arrow that he left at the door when he left home.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there's any indication that he was actually fighting in the war. Maybe he just used it for target practice or whatever. You know, or maybe exceptional because of who he was allowed to actually carry weapons. I don't know.
Right.
But generally, those Varnasankara, you know, such a person... You wouldn't be allowed.
No.
Because of his social position. The Kshatriya should bear arms, not the lower classes.
Mm-hmm. I remember...
Yeah, you know, but then, you know, for hunting, a hunter has a bow and arrow, but he uses them just to kill animals.
Right. Yeah. What about Gobadan Samskar? I mean, we always talk about it, and it seems like that our understanding of it is that you just can't... 50
that was Prabhupada's formula. Gopal Bhatta Goswami in the Satkriya Saradipika gives a somewhat more elaborate, you know, with pujas there and even a fire sacrifice, I think. And that's according to traditional system, although he streamlines it, his description of it, the way he formulates the samskaras, he's adapting, he's not... following, you know, all the details of what was done in earlier times.
Right, yeah, yeah. Does it, like, include, like, choosing a particular titi and maratha and all that?
I think he just mentions, that you should choose the proper titi, but that is stipulated in Manusmriti, the proper titis for Govardhan.
Right.
So he doesn't quote Manusmriti, but I think, you know, it's just understood that, you know, anybody living in a village in India can go to the Panditji and find out this information.
Yeah.
You know, some Gopalbhatta Goswami didn't consider it necessary to give that information. Yeah, everybody's supposed to, you know, have access to it.
I just remember that in the first philosophy of Bhakti verse, then there's a whole section, you know, for the Grihastha Dharma, and there's like, you know, what kind of woman to choose, and there's also what day you should procreate if you want a daughter or if you want a son. And, you know,
he's probably just quoting from the Dharma Shastras on that.
Right, yeah.
What philosophy is that?
First philosophy.
First philosophy?
Yeah.
No, first philosophy is about initiation.
Well, then it must be the second or third. There it's right at the beginning.
Well, not the second. Second is also initiation. And I haven't read much beyond that. Yeah. All right, it's there somewhere.
It is there. I just had one. Somebody put out one version of Paribhaja Bhatt. They picked and choose. You know, certain. You know, there's no complete versions out. So the one they got.
Well, there is such Kriya Sardipika. Yeah. Vidyapurna Maharaj has published it.
Yeah.
It's not, I don't know, maybe I have to go to Mayapur to get a copy, but it's, you know, it is there.
Right.
I have it on my computer also, and I have the original Sanskrit with Bengali translation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I just in Vrindavan this time, I saw the program for Bhakti Vidyapurna Maharaj's school.
Yes.
It's elaborate. It's like, it was like 12 or 14 years
yes.
course, and
yes.
you know, included in that was the, you know, the Bhakti Shastri, and then the Vaibhav, and then, you know, the older Sandarbhas, other Bhagavatamrita, Briya Bhagavatamrita, you know, Jiva Goswami Sanskrit, and like Chandas, and
very, very ambitious.
Yeah, it was very ambitious. Like, wow.
Yeah. But nobody
could
teach
them. Yeah, right. They didn't have the people that know the books.
They don't know.
Yeah. They're weak on is actual book knowledge.
Right.
I wanted to work with him, but it wasn't feasible for me to live in Mayapur.
Right. Yeah. I mean, guys would be in a good pair.
Well, we could work together in the sense that, you know, we could train up people for his school. And,
right. Oh, like that.
And steal a few of his graduates over.
Get his program and try to implement it, especially
here. Yeah, I mean, he's very expert in the practical principles of social organization. He knows that the, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he puts it into practice. Yeah. So that's about Achar, he knows a lot. Mm-hmm.
They teach Harinamrita Vikarna Bindu first.
I don't know what that is.
Bindu. I don't know who made that up.
I know the Lagu, but Bindu, I don't know what that could be.
The essential sutras. And, I don't know. Maybe
Maybe Vidvan Maranga is working on that, but yes, I don't know who's even doing that.
Maybe.
I never heard of it.
But who's teaching the essential sutras there? Vidvan Maranga?
Is there anybody other than Raghavendra teaching Sanskrit there?
Not yet. I mean, Vagisha knows something.
Yeah, Vagisha is working on the curriculum for her. It's all theoretical now.
Right.
You know, the outline's on paper, and they're working out. They're working it out now.
Right.
Doing research.
I see.
Vagisha is the specialist in Harinam Yukarna.
Oh, I see. Yeah,
had
they already started?
No, they're starting. The school's open, you know, right?
This
it's
already
September
supposed to.
September.
Yeah,
the
official opening.
Well, I mean, my son was in the ashram. Oh. You know, they had an ashram, but it was just a small ashram for younger boys, and now they're going to open up officially
in
September.
September already?
Well, the official beginning.
Next September.
September 2005?
Four,
next September.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, the next September, yeah.
Right.
Then you can get all the books you want.
Get what?
Books are there.
Oh, books are there.
It's amazing if somebody will sit there for 12 years and do it.
Well, he's had devotees work with him for years.
Yeah, that's true. Good quality.
Yeah. Hare Krishna. Okay, so we'll stop here. Thank you. All glory to Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai.